Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Impact of Mergers and Acquisitions for California Employers conference call. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Mark Turman. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Dringer, Biddle & Reeves' second California HR informational audiocast, this one on the impacts of mergers and acquisitions on California employers. With me today are our benefits lawyers, Summer Connolly and Heather Abrego, and my partner, Pascal Beniamini, on employment issues, and I'll also speak on employment issues. Let me tell you just briefly about our California HR group. We have more than a dozen benefits and employment lawyers in California, and we realize that our common interest is doing great work for our clients who, in almost every case, are employers. Some say across the country that things are different here in California. We know that there are challenges for California employers, and we put together our practice groups on both benefits and on the labor and employment side to focus on issues that our clients ask about on almost a daily basis. This audiocast will focus on merger and acquisition issues, which fortunately our economy is permitting us to do more and more work, and fortunately for your companies, you're having the opportunity to realize a sale opportunity and also realize acquisition opportunities. This presentation is being recorded. It will be posted to our firm website within a few days, where you can find us at www.drinkerbiddle.com under the Resources tab. Instructions will be given at the end of the presentation for asking questions. And without further introduction, I'm going to ask my colleague, Summer Connolly, to kick us off on issues in the benefits area.
Great. Thanks a lot, Mark, and good morning, everybody. I'm going to talk just a little bit about some of the health and welfare issues that come up in mergers and acquisitions. I think sometimes people tend to overlook the health and welfare benefit plans or not focus on them until the last possible minute, but there certainly are some various different issues that need to be taken into account when you're entering into a transaction. The first issue that pops up is an issue more on the seller side for whether or not they inadvertently create a MEWA. So often what happens is buyers don't have a health plan or aren't ready to put the acquired employees into their own health plan, and they may ask the seller to keep their employees on its health plan for some sort of transition period, for example, maybe until the end of the calendar year in which the transaction occurred. It's a common practice, and it does happen, but there's a few issues that the seller in particular needs to make sure that they are considering with this. In particular is the MEWA issue. A MEWA is a multiple employer welfare arrangement, and you have a MEWA if you have a group health plan that provides benefits to the employees of more than one employer. If you have a plan that is a MEWA, which generally people try to avoid, it's because the plan becomes subject to state insurance laws. And this is primarily an issue for self-funded plans, and especially in California, because California specifically does not allow a single employer to establish a self-funded MEWA. And so the seller is going to want to make sure that they're not creating a MEWA by offering this coverage during this transition period to the buyer's employees. I've had it come up a lot where this is being proposed, and somebody will say, well, there's an exception in the M-1 filing requirement for benefits being provided during a transition period. Well, the M-1 filing is a filing that's required under the DOL rules for a MEWA. And it is true that there is an exception for the transition coverage that we're talking about under the M-1 rules. But all that does is accept the MEWA from having to file the M-1. It does not provide an exception for a MEWA. So that's not really an exception that I think the seller should be rely upon, especially in California if they have a self-funded plan. One way to structure it is if the seller is only providing coverage to its former employees, the employees that the buyer has acquired during that transition period. There, I don't think you've created a MEWA because the seller is just providing continuation coverage for its former employees based on the former employment status as opposed to the employees of a separate employer. But I'd caution employers and caution the seller to be wary of the situation where the buyer wants the seller to also cover new employees that the buyer may hire after the deal has taken place and during the transition period. So there are ways to work it all out, but it's just certainly something that any time a seller is considering providing a transition period, they're going to want to think about the MIWA issue. Another issue that comes up in the group health plan context is with respect to COBRA and who's entitled to COBRA, who has to offer COBRA. And the general rule is that the seller has the obligation to offer COBRA coverage to the existing COBRA beneficiaries and any employees who are losing coverage as a result of the transaction or who are experiencing a qualifying event in relation to the transaction. But there are a number of exceptions, and both parties to the transaction need to be considering these. One of the first things to ask is whether or not it's a stock sale or an asset sale. And I think you'll probably hear that as a relevant question throughout the different presentations, as there are often different analyses depending on whether it's a stock sale or an asset sale. In the COBRA context, it makes a difference as to whether or not there's been a qualifying event. For the employees who are going over to the buyer, if it's an asset sale, that's considered a termination of employment for the employees, and if they're losing coverage under the seller's plan, that is a qualifying event that's going to entitle them to COBRA coverage. On the other hand, if it's a stock sale and the employees are going over to the buyer, that is not considered a termination of employment, and so it is not a qualifying event, and they are not entitled to be offered COBRA coverage. I mentioned before that the general rule is that the seller is responsible for offering COBRA coverage to those who are entitled to COBRA. One exception is if the seller is going to cease to maintain a plan as a result of the transaction, and that that's on a control group basis. In that case, the buyer may be liable for offering COBRA coverage as a successor employer, and it's important to kind of work through those rules and consider that if the seller is going to cease to offer health coverage. Another point to note is that the parties can contractually agree who is going to be liable for offering COBRA coverage. But what's important to remember here is that the regulations that set out who is responsible, whether it's the seller or the buyer, depending on the circumstances, ultimately control. So if you have a situation where the buyer is supposed to be liable for it, but the seller has taken on the obligation, or vice versa, and the party taking on the obligation does not fulfill its responsibilities, then the original party who is responsible under the COBRA regulations is still going to be on the hook for COBRA penalties. And so it's generally something to consider providing if you're going to transfer the liability, to make sure there is an indemnity provision in the agreement to protect the party who's transferring the liability. Flexible spending accounts are also another issue that comes up with how to deal with those. The IRS has issued guidance that address how or provide a few different alternatives as to how to address a flexible spending account in an asset sale. One option is for the seller to continue the plan and keep the transferred employees in its plan and have the buyer continue the same deductions out of the employee being paid to those transferred employees. And then they send that money back over to the seller and the employees are paid out of that plan. In that case, the employees haven't lost coverage, they haven't had a change in status event, and so they cannot change their election. Another alternative is for the seller to transfer the accounts to the buyer, and basically move over the FSA accounts for the transferred employees to the buyer. Again, here, because there's been no change for the employees cannot change their election. A couple things to think about here are whether or not the seller is going to be out money because, for example, if the transferred employees had incurred a number of expenses early on in the year and the full deductions had not been made throughout the whole year, if that's transferred over to the buyer, then the buyer is going to get the remaining deductions or the remaining contributions, whereas the seller paid the full cost from the beginning of the year. And oftentimes what I've seen here is the parties negotiate some sort of true-up that can occur after the transaction is complete. Or after the year is complete and they've seen kind of how things have worked out. If these approaches are not applied, then an alternative is to basically terminate the employee's eligibility under the seller plan. Depending on whether or not it's a stock sale or an asset sale, the employees may be entitled to COBRA coverage for the remainder of the year under the flexible spending account. Sometimes employers don't like the idea of this because of the use it or lose it rule, or again, the same issue where the seller could be out if the lots of early claims had been made before employees had made their full contributions. HIPAA is another issue to think about in these types of deals. Oftentimes, as part of due diligence, the buyers may be asking for a considerable amount of information regarding the seller's health plan, including claims experience. I caution that that is considered protected health information and is going to be subject to these rules. Sellers should be careful to think about whether or not they want to obtain an authorization. Probably not, because oftentimes this information is requested before the deal is even made public or known. They don't want to go seek the authorization. They may be able to provide de-identified information, which is where a number of factors have been taken out so that it is no longer considered protected health information. Or there may be a limited exception if the covered entities are merging. And so it's just something to make sure you're thinking about before you hand over all that information to the buyer. And the last thing I want to just mention is the Affordable Care Act. The employer mandate will take effect next year in 2015, and so that will create a few new items that buyers and sellers are going to want to think about. Small companies looking to make an acquisition are going to need to consider whether the acquisition is going to kick them over the 50-employee level and make them an applicable large employer subject to the Affordable Care Act. And then as part of due diligence, the buyer, especially in a stock sale, is going to want to look closely at how the seller was keeping track of full-time employees and who the seller was offering the coverage to make sure that if there's any possibility for penalties under the Affordable Care Act, that the buyer is well aware of those. So those are just a few of the health and welfare plan issues to think about in mergers and acquisitions. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Heather Abrego, to talk about some of the qualified plan issues that may come up.
Before we go to Heather, I'll just remind our listeners that we will have an opportunity for questions near the end of the presentation. Please jot a note down to yourselves along the way. The operator will come back and arrange for you to give your question in audio form at the end.
All right. Thanks so much, Mark. Well, the one thing I want to do is kind of do a public service announcement for us as employee benefit attorneys, because a lot of times when we get involved in the mergers and acquisitions, it's always at the 12th hour. You know, we get that last minute call that says, oh, hey, by the way, we're merging this plan. Can you take a look at it and make sure that it's okay? And it happens, but it happens rarely, but it does happen in that the closing actually has to be delayed because there's some serious issues with respect to the retirement plans and or the health and welfare. So I just kind of want to mention that the sooner we get involved, the sooner we can clean things up, point out issues that, you know, may affect the purchase price. So that's kind of my public service announcement for our industry. So without further ado, let me kind of go into, you know, Summer had kind of mentioned the two types of transactions. And with respect to the retirement plan concept, I want to make sure that everybody understands why it's so important. Because it's going to affect whether or not you decide to terminate the plan, both on the buyer and seller side, but it's also going to be important because when you're drafting that purchase agreement and you're doing your due diligence, you have to know exactly how much liability you're taking, and that depends on whether or not it's an asset sale or a stock sale. So if it's an asset sale and the buyer's not assuming the plan, then what you're probably going to want to do is terminate that plan prior to the closing date. And the reason that's usually something that we consider is because there's a set of rules, as I think Summer had mentioned in her topics, the successor employer issues. So you want to avoid that. You want your participants to be able to take a distribution. So you want to go ahead and terminate prior to close. That would be appropriate in an asset sale. In a stock sale, you know, normally what happens is that you terminate before closing. You terminate the 401k plan or other type of plan prior to close, but it's just not as important as it is in an asset sale. What really at that, for the stock sale folks, you know, what is important is that your purchase agreement contains, you know, a lot of indemnifications and that you kind of cover all the different contingencies that might take place in a stock sale. In a stock sale, the seller's legal identity and status as an employer for plan purposes does not change. So that's why you need to have all those contingencies out there to make sure you cover any possible issue. So the first thing that we normally do as employee benefit attorneys is we do a due diligence. So we're requested, you know, we get that phone call that says, oh, hey, I'm merging on Friday. Could you go ahead and look at everything? And we already have our data room, and could you go in there and just take a quick look at everything? Well, I mean, the first thing that we need to do from our perspective is make sure that we understand exactly all the employee benefit plans that are in place. And this doesn't just mean the written plan document, you know, looking at the 5500s and the plan documents. There also could be some oral employee benefit plans that, you know, nobody ever really thought of. So that's something that we're going to look at when we start our due diligence. We also look to see if, you know, if it's involving a church, if there's any church plans, of course, all the ERISA plans, any trusts, any VEBAs, which are Voluntary Employee Benefits Association plans, if there's a rabbi trust for non-qualified plans, and any third-party service agreements. So we really look at the entire gamut of any possible document that's out there that might indicate there's an employee benefit plan. And also what's really important, I think often overlooked, is any retiree health plan. I think a lot of employers out there offer retiree health plans, especially employers that have union employees. They offer some sort of retiree health plan, and maybe it's just something that they've been doing over the years in an informal document, something that they promise when everybody retires that they're going to offer health insurance for a certain amount of years or some sort of coverage, but it's something that it's not as obvious as your 401k plan or your defined benefit plan. It's something that's a little bit more hidden and maybe not at the out and open. So that's something that we always ask about. And the reason why it's important to know if there's a retiree health plan is because, you know, unfunded retiree medical benefits could be pretty costly, and they also need to be indicated on the financial statement. So not only is it important for us to make sure that those plans are compliant, but it's also, from a purchase price perspective, you need to know exactly what's going to be taken as part of that purchase, you know, price and what you're going to consider, and the financial statements all have to accurately reflect that. So I think it's really important, as you can see, that we look to see the entire gamut of all possible employee benefit plans, and that's what we start with. And then, of course, we go through, you know, your ERISA plans and other plans. We look for ERISA and code compliance. So Summer, I mean, I'll just take it from you. I mean, I think, you know, when we usually go into the data room, when I go into the data room, it's never as apparent, you know, the documents that they put up there, because of course those are the documents they want to show. I've always had a situation where I have a problem, and it's because I've asked for additional documentation, and that's where I see the issues. Is that normally the case that you have?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times you start asking for the documents, and all of a sudden they're not quite sure where those plan documents are or where the most current amendments are and that sort of thing. So I think that you're right that the first thing you want to make sure you're doing is really getting a hold of everything that might possibly be there, and where there are gaps, making sure everybody's aware of what those gaps are and how to address them.
Yeah, and I mean, we have the checklist that we use, you know, to make sure that we're getting everything. And I think the most fearful word that we can ever hear from a client is when we ask for the plan document, they ask us what a plan document is or what a summary plan description is, and then we know, well, that's going to be another 2 weeks to push back that close. So those are some of the things that we look at. So just to kind of give you an idea, I mean, we clearly look at the reporting disclosure, so that would be the 5500, and, you know, whether or not the plans are funded or unfunded and how that affects the plans. The biggest thing is we look at the coverage and non-discrimination requirements. So clearly for some safe harbor plans, you're not going to have discrimination issues, but, you know, for the majority of them, we definitely want to take a look at what that third-party administrator is doing and whether or not those discrimination, you know, reports are correct. I mean, I've had a situation where we actually had received the discrimination reports, and they were all wrong. And so we just want to make sure that, you know, all that is correct. We also look, you know, just to make sure that the benefits are being paid appropriately, that the contributions by the employee and employer are being done, and any vesting requirements. Now, what happens when we find a problem? Well, you can fix a problem, but if you got to get us in there quick enough, because if there's a problem, we can go to the IRS and do what's called a voluntary compliance program application. And sometimes that may even require putting some money into an escrow account. So, you know, all those things can be fixed, but again, you've got to get us in there quick enough. For those folks out there that have union employees, I mean, you've got to make sure that you review any commitments to the union employees. So the reason for that is because you're going to have obligations that continue after close. Some of the changes in benefits may require the union approval. I've seen in some, you know, arrangements where they have what's called a zipper clause that can limit the buyer's ability to change employment terms or conditions that are not in the collective bargaining agreement. And then the biggest thing is you have to identify any multi-employer pension plan and or retiree medical obligations under the union. So real quick, a multi-employer pension plan withdrawal liability occurs when the employer withdraws from an unfunded pension plan. So we're talking here about a defined benefit plan. In a stock purchase, it can result in the buyer assuming potential withdrawal liability as a contingent liability. In an asset sale, it could trigger also withdrawal liability for the seller. Now, there are certain industries that are really affected by some of these, and there are special rules that apply to them. Some of those industries are the building and construction industries of trucking, entertainment, and retail food. So if you're within those industries and you have a defined benefit plan or you're contributing to a union defined benefit plan, you really got to pay attention because there's some special rules there. There's also some defined benefit plan issues for those single employers out there. You know, there are going to be some reporting obligations and financial obligations when the operations are stopped at the facility and more than 20% of the employees participating in the plan are terminated. What that it happens in that situation is that the employer is treated as a withdrawing employer from a multiple employer plan. So there's some reporting that you have to do with the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation within 60 days after the event. And in some situations, you may have to provide a bond or an escrow.
So yeah, they're really starting to enforce that, so that's something and definitely an issue to make sure you're paying attention to if you have a defined benefit plan in that type of situation.
Yep, absolutely. And financial, you know, guarantees, you know, they're not required of companies with fewer than 100. There are some exceptions for creditworthy companies in providing that escrow and bond, but it doesn't mean you don't have to report. So if you're a creditworthy company, you still have to report. You just may get out of the escrow and bond. Clearly, representations in a purchase agreement. You know, in stock sale, like I mentioned before, you've got to make sure that you're covering any sort of contingency. You've got to make sure your indemnification provisions cover not just the employee benefit plans, but are also incorporated in the general indemnification buckets. You may need to negotiate appropriate adjustments in the purchase price. You may need to have an escrow provision. You may, I've been in deals where we've had to rearrange the entire purchase price, where we had to do installment payments after certain issues on the 401k plan were resolved. In some situations, there's a notice requirement. You know, the most common would be the 204H, or it's a notice that applies to DB benefit plans when you start reducing the benefits in the plan. There's a 45-day advance notice requirement. And last but not least, you need to be looking at the controls group and affiliated service group liability. I know that Summer mentioned it, you know, with respect to the health and welfare, but you also have to make sure that, you know, you're looking at it from the retirement plans because you could have testing across the affiliates of the buyers. And there's a bunch of other, you know, issues that could come into play if you don't know who the controlled and affiliated group companies are. So without further ado, I will go ahead and pass it on back to Mark. And let you take it from here.
Great. Thanks, Heather. I'm going to talk about two major areas in summary form, of course, given the format of our program today. One is the California WARN Act, and the second is California restrictive covenant issues. On the California WARN Act, you may know that there is a federal statute called the Workers Adjustment and Retraining Act, and there is a California statute that is similar. You may also know that in employment law, the employee gets the better of federal or state law, whichever is more favorable to the employee. In the Cal WARN Act area, in almost every case, the provisions are more favorable to the employee than the federal law. And we're going to focus on that a bit today and highlight some substantial issues. In a stock sale, the WARN Act is often less of an issue because the workforce, for the most part, is transferring, or actually is not transferring, is staying with the entity, just the ownership is changing. There are times, though, in a transaction where there will be a substantial change in the composition of the workforce, either pre-closing or post-closing, and so CalWARN will be an issue there. In an asset deal, CalWARN is always an issue. Why? Because there is the potential that there will be deemed an end of employment and a new employer put into place. And I'll go over the very limited exception to that. In the big picture, there's a notice requirement under the CalWARN statute that employees be given 60 days advance notice of a mass layoff, a relocation of the employer, or a termination of the covered establishment, and what that means in normal language is a plant closing. The notice has to be given to all affected employees and also to a handful of governmental agencies such as the California Employment Development Department, the appropriate officers in the city and county, and the like. There are a couple of exceptions. I'll let you know what they are, but they're beyond the scope of our conversation today, where there's a natural disaster or a faltering company. Certainly in the purchase and sale business, it's usually not a natural disaster situation. Hopefully it's a great opportunity for everybody. But in the faltering company scenario, I just want you to know that it's an issue because often a sale is driven where when a company is under distress and urgently looking for an acquisition opportunity to fish them out of that calamity. What employers are covered? Well, it's any employer who has at least 75 employees. That means we count all employees, full-time and part-time. If the parent entity is the one involved in the transaction, you count the employees of both the parent and all the affected subsidiaries. So it is assumed that the broadest possible counting that you could imagine will be the one that is to be used. It isn't always that case, but that's a safe assumption. And if that's the situation, so many companies have 75 or more employees in California that we're talking about almost every transaction that we're going to see. There are exceptions to where there are seasonal employees and a couple other exceptions, but 75 employees, and that's less than the threshold under federal law. There's an issue for successor liability, which is particularly important in the transaction situation. The California WARN Act does not specifically address who's responsible for providing the layoff notice upon the sale of a going business. Although the purchaser of corporate assets is generally insulated from the debts and liabilities of the predecessor, at least one court has concluded that the purchaser of the business may still be responsible on a successor liability theory for giving the layoff notice under the California Act. This is a very important issue, particularly like so many others in a transaction. There is an allocation and indemnity issues that are negotiated and sometimes hotly negotiated between the buyer and seller. For example, there are some transactions where neither the buyer nor the seller want to give that 60-day advance notice if it's required, because the secrecy of the transaction is more important than the potential liability under the WARN Act. We'll get you a couple of ideas of what the liability exposure is, but the successor liability issue is one that you need to be thinking about. Covered events, as I said, a mass layoff, which under our statute means that it's at least 50 employees during any 30-day period. A relocation is what it says. It's a relocation of the office or plant or commercial facility for more than 100 miles. And the termination of a covered establishment, as I said earlier, in normal language, that's a plant closing. Let me come back to the layoff issue and highlight something that's very important in the asset deal scenario. So in a layoff, our statute doesn't address whether a separation from a position for lack of funds or work, how you deal with that in an asset transaction. Fortunately, at least one court has said that where the employees of the seller are transferred to the new employer to perform the same work at the same rate of pay with the same benefits, then the Cal WARN Act notice is not triggered. You can imagine that there are plenty of issues that we'll need to address if not all the workers are transferred and not all the same rates of pay are paid and not all the benefits are the same. So while the courts have helped us out in some respects, they've highlighted the issue that that we need to deal with. Let me highlight a couple of last items, which is, why does it matter? Well, the liability for failure to provide notice is back pay, meaning that all compensation and benefits that would have been earned or accrued during the 60-day period are due to those employees. Again, there may be an issue on allocation of that responsibility, should notice not be given, between the buyer and the seller. Also, there are several penalties for an employer who failed to give the requisite notice of $500 for each day of the violation during that period of time that notice should have been given. I'm next going to move to a topic of restrictive covenants. And this is an issue that all of you have probably dealt with in some measure in California. It is just very difficult to be an employer and not know that our California statute and public policy is highly critical and highly difficult when it comes to the enforceability of any kind of restriction or covenant that prevents an employee from engaging in their trade or profession when they leave their employment. Fortunately, in the purchase and sale situation, there is a statutory exception where the covenant not to compete can be enforceable. It needs to be reasonable in time. Usually 3 to 5 years is reasonable by most courts' measures. The scope needs to be reasonable as well, either limited to the geographic area where the employer does their work, or it can be a broader territory if the employer is indeed one that services its clients on a national basis. There are issues here for both the buyer and the seller. Certainly the buyer doesn't want to acquire a lawsuit, for example, in a stock transaction where the agreements are all inherited. The buyer wants to look at these restrictive covenants to see whether they're enforceable in California. And in this instance, I'm talking about the employees who are non-owners. Certainly most of you know and have dealt with the situation where the restrictive covenant is attempted to be enforced against a non-owner employee who's not going to be covered by that statutory exception. And the courts, in the short version, are in flux. There were many years where the California courts allowed us to rely on what was known as the trade secret exception to what would otherwise be a void covenant not to compete for post-employment activity. The courts, the state courts, have gravitated towards being critical of that exception, and some have said it doesn't exist anymore, that an employer can merely attempt to enforce their confidentiality agreements, their trade secret rights, and their invention assignment rights, but cannot have a restrictive covenant. At the same time, the federal courts sitting in California have given employers a bit more leeway. You don't always know ahead of time what court you're going to be in. So whether you're a buyer and looking at these agreements that you may be inheriting, or you may be asking your newly acquired workforce or your key employees to sign agreements, these issues are important and you need to talk to counsel about it. If you're a seller, this is often something you want to think about ahead of time, way in advance of a transaction. I think there's a theme here that the earlier counsel can be involved in helping you plan for a transaction, whether you're selling or acquiring, the better off you'll be, the more prepared you'll be, and the less opportunity there will be for surprises, and the more opportunity we'll all have to help you deal with them. I'm going to shift gears now and turn the microphone over to Pascal Beniamini.
Thank you, Mark, and good morning, everybody, or good afternoon, depending on what time zone you're in. There are certainly many issues that are unique to California, and that's why we are we're focusing on some of those issues today. And I will be discussing some of the wage and hour issues, leave aspects, policies, but I'll also touch on some of the non-California issues as well, because I think it just merges well together. Any sort of transaction, whether you're looking at an asset deal or a stock deal, it's very important to look at multiple documents. Sometimes even the transaction itself may not be a pure stock deal or a pure asset deal. It may be a group of investors investing money into a company and taking over 50% of that company. So it's important to know the universe of the potential exposure that you face as a buyer. And as a seller, you also want to know, you want to make sure that you have your ducks in order when you're selling so that there are no surprises down the line. Some of the key documents you want to look at are like the employee handbook. That's crucial. And in our experience, a lot of handbooks do not get updated. So it's important to find out when's the last time that handbook was updated. Because in at least in California, our recommendation to clients is that every two years, you should be looking at the handbook and determining whether you need to make some updates. Other documents, as Mark discussed, the restrictive covenants, any contracts, employment contracts that you might have that override the presumption of at-will in California. CBA, collective bargaining agreements that may apply depending on the situation. And more specifically, some documents that I like to see because it tells me a lot about the company is the organizational chart and the employee roster with job descriptions. A lot of companies do not have job descriptions, but to the extent they're available, I think it's crucial to look at those and make sure they're current. And also, I'd like to see sample time cards. I'd like to see how the company is paying the employees. Are they following wage and hour rules, like overtime, meal and rest periods? Those very, very important. And the where I'm going now is in the area of exempt versus non-exempt classification of employees, which is a big ticket in California because the laws are quite onerous, both in California and federal law. I mean, the onerous part of federal law is that officers and managers who actually control the decision to misclassify employees by not paying overtime may be subject personally to liability, whereas in California, one aspect that's onerous is the dual test that we have of the salary requirement and the job duties requirement that makes it onerous in California. So, for example, on the salary side, currently, for somebody to be properly classified as exempt, you need to pay them twice the minimum wage, which is $8 an hour. So, on an annual basis, it's $33,280. But hold on, because that's going up significantly to $37,440 on July 1, because the minimum wage in California is going to $9 an hour. And there are jurisdictions in California that the minimum wage is greater than that, so you have to be mindful of that. The second test is the job duties test, and you want to see if the employee spends routinely more than 50% of his or her time performing exempt duties. And a lot of litigation arises in this area. I'm going to just touch on the categories of exemptions because this topic alone can consume an entire hour or two. You got the executive exemption, the administrative exemption, the commission salespeople exemption, and then you have the professional exemption, and under that you have a series of additional exemptions like licensed professionals, learned professionals, artists, computers, and in some industries, nurses. Okay, and by the way, if you do not properly classify employees, you're looking at potentially up to 4 years of unpaid wages plus interest, statutory penalties, and attorneys. And in a stock deal, you're taking, as Mark mentioned, you're taking over the operation. So it's very important to understand how things are done. In an asset deal, while you're not taking over the operation, a lot of times what companies do is they rehire the same workforce, and they tend to continue operating the same way as the prior company has, and it takes them maybe 3-4 months or 6 months or sometimes even up to a year to start making changes. And that time is very significant in terms of potential liability and exposure for the company that has taken over, even in an asset deal. So while you may not be responsible for prior practice, you're now putting yourself in a potential exposure situation with continuing a practice that may not have been lawful or non-compliant. Another area that is very important is the classification of independent contractors. A lot of companies try to avoid paying payroll taxes. They try to avoid some of the laws that do not apply to independent contractors. And it's important to make sure that contractors are properly classified. as with the exempt, non-exempt, the independent contractor classification, the burden is on the employer to show proper classification. In 2012, there were new penalties that were implemented to punish California employers who willfully misclassify individuals as independent contractors. The willful misclassification under this law means avoiding employee status for an individual by voluntarily and knowingly misclassifying that individual as an independent contractor. And the violations can be significant. If there are a labor commissioner proceedings or court proceedings and they determine that a violation has occurred, the penalties can range from $5,000 to $15,000 per violation, and this is an initial violation. If there are, if there's a pattern in practice, the penalties can then jump to $10,000 to $25,000 per violation. Another issue is obviously immigration compliance, I-9 forms. You want to make sure that the company has properly maintained the I-9 forms. Then some addition, now I'm going to go into really California-specific issues. The Wage Theft Protection Act, this is section 2810.5 of the Labor Code. This is a law that went into effect, again, in January 2012, and it added this section to the Labor Code. The Act requires that all employers provide non-exempt employees with a written notice that contains specified information at the time of hire. And for those of you who haven't looked at the notice recently, I suggest you do. It can be found at www.dir.ca.gov. It has some very onerous requirements. For example, it requires you to give notice to an employee who just started all information about the workers' comp insurance that you carry. And we know how big workers' comp fraud is in California, and a lot of companies struggle with that. And that's separate and aside from the regular posting that you need to have in your workforce. Another issue that I'd like to discuss is the commission agreements. In January 2013, Labor Code Section 2751 was added to make sure that employers have a written agreement with those employees that get commission. There are some exceptions, for example, like retail clerks do not need to have that. Additional issues we deal with are PTO and vacation. In California, there is no use it or lose it policy. So a lot of times we see companies trying to transfer existing vacation that the seller has, and oftentimes the seller has not really kept a good track of how much vacation has been accrued, or they don't have a cap on how much vacation has been accrued. So I've seen situations where the seller has employees with 3-4 months of vacation that has accrued, and now they don't know what to do with it in terms of payout, because that's a significant burden on the seller and potentially on the buyer if it's a stock deal. Sick leave is another hot topic in California. In contrast to vacation and PTO, you can have a use it or lose it policy in California, but what you want to make sure is that you haven't allowed, or the seller hasn't allowed the employee to use a sick leave to go on vacation, for example, because now there may be some commingling issues that you have to deal with. There are some leaves of absences that are unique to California. You have the California Pregnancy Disability Leave. You have the time off to visit with school authorities. You have the Organ and Bone Marrow Donor Leave. And the Organ and Bone Marrow Donor Leave applies to employers with 15 or more employees. And it's a paid leave, by the way, in contrast to some of the other leaves that are not paid. And you have a couple of others, Literacy Education and Alcohol and Drug Rehabilitation Leave. And finally, you have under FEHA, the Fair Employment Housing Act, you have protected classifications that are more protective and more expansive in California. For example, marital status, sexual orientation and identity. You have a status as a victim of domestic violence, assault, or stalking. Stalking is something that was just recently added this year to the code. So with all that, it's very important to make sure that at the onset you're getting all the documents you need and get your lawyers involved early. I can echo the public announcement that Heather made about getting lawyers involved early to make sure that we identify the issues and the transaction can close in a timely fashion. Thank you.
Just to follow on there, a significant piece about why we're reminding you of all the protected classes under California law is that when there is a planning for the transfer of a workforce and the buyer or the seller or both are deciding who is going forward, when the disparate impact analysis is done, all these protected classes, especially people who are out on leave of absence, are warning flags that must be factored into that disparate impact analysis in evaluating what the workforce is going to look like after the transaction. At this point, I'm going to ask the operator to give us all instructions about questions, and I have a couple that came in to us directly that we'll start with first, but please, Ms. Operator, tell us what we do.
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. Again, that's star 1 to signal for a question at this time.
While we're waiting for those questions to come in, let me start with the ones that we have in hand already. This one I'm going to cover. It's in the restrictive covenant area, and the question is this: to satisfy the purchase and sale exception on restrictive covenants in California, can an employer just issue a few shares in the company and have the buyer buy them? I think the proper question would be, can the company just buy them back from the employee, therefore satisfying the restriction issue? Well, that's a clever idea, but unfortunately the California courts have already dealt with that, and that's known as a sham covenant. And it actually happened in the context of very large and popular medical practice where one or two shares were issued to the doctors, and upon the end of their employment, they would receive book value. And there wasn't the 3 to 5% of shares that the courts would look for to see if that was a real ownership or a substantial covenant, and the purchase price didn't include a measure of goodwill. I'll continue with what we have here until the operator interrupts me. This one's for Summer. Here is my question. In a stock sale, if the buyer will not offer health coverage to the acquired employees, must the seller offer COBRA coverage to the acquired employees?
And that's a good question. I've actually had that come up before, and it usually comes as a surprise to people. I mentioned before that it's really important for determining whether or not you have a qualifying event. You have to determine if it's a stock sale or if it's an asset sale. And if it's a stock sale, the employees being acquired by the buyer do not have a qualifying event. They haven't had a termination of employment, and so they are not entitled to COBRA. And this is true even if the buyer's not going to have a health plan. So the employee may be losing coverage under the seller's plan as a result of the transaction, but because they have not had a termination of employment, they are not entitled to be offered COBRA.
Great. Thanks, Summer.
As a reminder, that is star 1 to signal for a question on the phone.
Here's one I have for Heather. Heather, do plans get favorable determination letters when the plans are terminated prior to the close?
And that's a common question that we come across. There is one thing I do want to mention before I answer this question is that, you know, Pascal talked a lot about classification of employees and how important that is, and I want to mention that's a huge issue also on the employee benefit side. because you want to make sure that, you know, those employees are properly classified because they could be eligible for benefits under the plan. So I just wanted to mention that in advance. But to the question of a favorable determination letter, you know, I've had both and had the discussions on both sides, representing the buyer and representing the seller. You know, as everybody knows, and let me go back, a favorable determination letter is a document issued by the Internal Revenue Service that says that your plan document is qualified and it meets all the various requirements. The reason why sometimes that's important is because if you terminate the plan and you want the employees of the seller to be able to roll over their account balances into the buyer's plan, you'd want to see that there's a favorable determination letter. Sometimes, though, you know, you're looking at sometimes between 7 months to a year before you can get that favorable determination letter, and nobody really wants to tell their employees they're going to have to wait 7 months before they can roll over their distributions. So in some cases, this is not feasible from a time perspective, but let me give you a quick example of when it was important. I represented a seller, and in reviewing their plans, the buyer's employee benefits council had raised probably about, if I could put a money number on it, it was about $4 million of issues. And so what we had to do was we had to go in for a voluntary compliance application prior to any monies being distributed from the plan. Then as part of the negotiations, it was required by the buyer's council that not only we go through the VCP, but we also get a favorable determination letter. So we were looking at a 2-year post-closing window before anybody could distribute their accounts from the seller's plan. Now, the interesting thing was we ended up having to allow the folks before we received the favorable determination letter to be able to roll over their assets because there was other issues and you can't require somebody, or you can't prohibit somebody from taking their money out of the plan. So in that situation, while a favorable determination letter was required by the buyer's counsel, I think it really was something that wasn't probably necessary in that situation since we had gone in for a VCP, we had gotten a compliance statement, and the plan was okay. But, you know, that was a one-off situation, and I think it's just one of those things that you're going to have to look on a plan-by-plan and situation-by-situation basis.
Thanks, Heather. I think we've got a question in from the operator.
Yes, this is Bill Harn with City National Bank. Two quick questions. One is, if you're moving employees and they're not losing employment because in a asset sale they're going to have jobs with the new employer, can they still be offered COBRA even if you're not required to offer it? And then number two is, if you're moving, let's say 90% of the employees are going to have successor employment, so they're not losing a position, but maybe 10% will lose their job in, say, 3 to 6 months, would you need to give a WARN Act notice at 60 days in advance of the changeover for the 90% or 60 days in advance of the 10% losing their positions down the road?
Well, I'll go ahead and start with the COBRA side of that. And I think you mentioned in your example that it was an asset sale. And there, even if the employees are going to be hired by the buyer, if it's an asset sale, it is considered a termination of employment. They're going to lose coverage under the seller's plan, and that is going to be a qualifying event, and they are going to need to be offered COBRA coverage under the seller's plan. As a practical matter, they may not want to elect it because they're going to have coverage under the buyer's plan, but they are entitled to be offered COBRA. If it were a stock sale and it were not a qualifying event, while you're not required to offer COBRA coverage, you certainly can offer COBRA-like coverage that's, you know, going above and beyond what's required. Again, that kind of gets into, like, my transition issues that I was talking about, where if the seller is offering coverage to former employees in COBRA-like coverage, that's certainly going to be permissible, but you want to be careful about offering coverage to new employees of the buyer.
Let me, before I take the second part of that question, there's an interesting issue in the COBRA area, is that if a company is sold and no longer in business, there is sometimes an issue whether there is a plan to continue at all. So, for example, if employer number one ends its health plan on the closing and employer number two doesn't have a plan and prefers that its employees go under the Affordable Care Act, and they pay through that way, there may be a nuance there that there may not be a COBRA to actually continue.
I think that would depend on whether or not the buyer is a successor employer, and you'd have to look at that. The rule,
right,
as far as not having an officer COBRA, there has to be no plan on a controlled group basis, but then you're also going to have to consider the successor employer rules to see if the buyer has an obligation to offer.
You bet. Going to the second part of the question, if I understood it properly, I think the shorthand on that is that the notice requirement is 60 days in advance of the event that will impact the affected employees. So if you have a two-stage planning that you've asked about, and in the first stage there's nobody affected because there's no mass layoff, but in a later stage after the transaction there may be, I'd be thinking in terms of giving the 60-day notice in advance of that second step.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure. The next question I have here is for Pascal. There are penalties that the Labor Code imposes for failure to pay all wages due by the end of employment. How does that affect transactions?
Yeah, it's a very important issue. As Summer just mentioned, in an asset deal, there's a termination of employment. And so what happens is at least Labor Code Section 203, which is known as the waiting time penalty, will get triggered if the employees who of the seller are not paid their final wages at the day of termination, on the day of termination, and also if they're not paid their full vacation or other benefits that the company may have on the day of termination. So even though a buyer will take over in an asset deal and rehire all the employees or substantially all the employees of the seller, you still have a 203 penalty that gets triggered if the seller doesn't pay the vacation benefits, accrued vacation benefits, and final wages upon termination. And the amount can be significant. It's under Section 203, it's the daily rate of pay for up to 30 days. So if someone is making $100 an hour, that's $3,000 just in penalties for not having complied with Labor Code Section 203.
You mean $100 a day?
I'm sorry, did I say an hour?
Yep.
Yeah, I tend to do that because, you know, but it's $100 a day, yes.
Actually, here's another question, and I'll take it. What if the buyer is compliant with classifying its employees as exempt, but the seller is not? And we've had this come up, and it's really thrown a curveball into the transaction. We had a client not too long ago that was considering a transaction, and they had counseled with us early on, followed our advice, and had reclassified their exempt and non-exempt workers so they were as close as they could reasonably be to California law. But the target company that they were thinking of acquiring had not gone through that process and were actually quite not really interested in thinking about it at all. And it did two things. One is it caused a reassessment of the transaction, both in terms of what the financial impact could be on what kind of liability the buyer could potentially be taken on. And also, I think it was part of a conversation of company culture and whether the target was actually a good target for this particular client.
Do we have time for one more question?
Sure.
I see one. So this is something I got in earlier. The question is, what happens if a buyer wants to change the vacation policy in a stock deal? So so my understanding is that the buyer takes over in a stock deal and is not happy with the vacation policy that the seller had. And so in such a situation, the new ownership can change the vacation policy going forward, But there are two things. One, you want to give reasonable notice to the workforce that the change is coming. And second, you want to make sure that employees are not divested of any of their accrued vacation. So anyone who has actually accrued and earned that vacation, you cannot avoid paying that. Sometimes an issue comes up when a company has provide advances on vacation. So they allow, for example, their workforce to take a week of vacation in January or February, and then they let them accrue it and pay it back in a sense. And that's fine. I don't prefer those arrangements, but when they do happen and then you start making changes to the vacation accrual midway through, now you have a group of employees who already used up their vacation and another group of employees who haven't. So that creates a lot of issues that need to be looked at carefully to make sure that employees are being treated equally and no one's losing the vacation that they've earned.
With that said, we're right at our time for closing. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us today. Our hope, and hopefully we've accomplished that goal, is to provide issues of value to you that you will indeed run into when you're involved in M&A transactions. If again, I'll note that our website is www.drinkerbiddle.com. In a few days, under the Resources tab, there will be a copy of this audio cast in case there was something you wanted to go back and review. If you'd like to give an email or a call to Heather, Summer, Pascal, or me, you're welcome to. We're happy to be of service, and we'll wish you a great day. Thank you.